Okay, reading from the Sri Briya Bhagavatamrita.
Sorry.
Text 2, 1, 13. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bhakta Bhagavato Yetu Sakama Svechayakilam. Bunjana Shuka Bogam Ste Vishudha Yanti Tatpadam. Now today I'm going to go through the word for word, because as I've been studying this verse, it still wasn't clear after I studied it. So, Bhakta, devotees, Bhagavata, of the personality of Godhead, Yehu, to but, Sakama, with material desires, Swaichaya, willfully, Akilan, all, Bhunjana, indulging in, Shuka, enjoyable, Bhoga, pleasures, Te, they, Vishuddha, fully purified, Yanti, go, Tat, do that, Padam, abode. Translation, but even the devotees of the personality of Godhead, who still have material desires, can enjoy the pleasures they wish, and then become fully purified and go to the Lord's abode. Purport. Vaishnava devotees are more elevated than non-devotee paramahamsas. Even a devotee burdened by material desires is in a better position than an impersonalist free from such desires. Still, just as both karmis and jnanis are distinguished in terms of their relative freedom from material desires, so also are bhaktas. Most karmis and jnanis can approach perfection only gradually. Only a few paramahamsa jnanis achieve immediate liberation. Similarly, though all Vaishnavas are sure candidates for ultimate perfection, the Sakama Bhaktas, those whose devotion to the personality of Godhead is mixed with the desire to control and enjoy, must first become purified. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Taksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurudev Namah. Vairagya Yuga Bhakti Risham Priyatnai Payamamanabit Samandam Kupambriya Paraduka Duki Sanatanistam Prabhumasriyami Vansha Kalpa Turu Jyusha Kripa Shindu Baye Bucha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from Vrindavan. It's into December, the weather is still absolutely as good as the weather can get. You don't need a jacket. Even now I'm just sitting in a kurta without a t-shirt. I'm staying in a little bit different place. We're very fortunate now that after so many years, Giriraj Swami is kind of staying back in the Dham. He thought he'd stay for a long while, but he's going to, looks like he's going to stay through January. And by his grace, I had residence here for many years. But I had to find another place. But having just a little disassociation is worth having him here, even if there's some little inconvenience to me. But being in Vrindavan, I always kind of felt for many, many years, I thought this way, that residence here is great mercy. And any residence here is great mercy. Anyway, I'm in the same cul-de-sac. And I have more of a little sadhu's room, and I'm sitting now at this kind of makeshift desk over a window that overlooks the path that comes in. So as I'm working and writing all day, it's really beautiful because I see all the sadhus coming into the ashram. And, you know, I see them. They don't see me, but I see their hearts. I see them, you know, chanting and spontaneously. So it's just reaffirms to me the glory of Vrindavan. In fact, a friend of mine sent me a quote today which I could really identify with if I can find it. It says, if one love lives in the earthly land of Vrindavan, touches it, travels to it, meditates upon it, bows down to offer respects to it, sings or hears about its glorious qualities, carries its dust on his head, has any relationship with it, then this purifying earthly Vrindavan will carry him to the supreme abode of Vrindavan in the spiritual world. And that you really feel the mood here. urbanization and not, the more I come here, the more I appreciate the potency, especially at this time of the year. I'm very busy. I enjoy it. I take people around. I don't want anybody here coming to miss a good experience here. But now I'm kind of, I should have a couple of weeks now where I don't have any responsibilities outside of my room. And it's the way I used to live here most of the time. And just the Vrindavan sadhu, a simple life, simple eating, just chanting, writing, and giving my class. We had a specially enlivening class today discussing Brahma Vimohan Lila. We know that Krishna manifested himself as all the calves and cows. And we get a vision of what the spiritual world is like, because now that they're children are actually Krishna. They actually had more attachment for Krishna than their children. Now that Krishna is manifest for their children, they're having more attachment to their children. But it shows what attachment to Krishna is and the force. It's an attraction. It's an absorption. One gets lost in it. It's the ultimate attraction. And because it's Krishna, it's so forceful, so overwhelming. Because it's Krishna. Krishna means all attractive. He's the ultimate object of love, and therefore the ultimate object of attraction, and he draws one's consciousness towards him. So we see the resonance of Vrindavan. When the cowherd men see their children, they become just absorbed in their paternal affection. And even when they have to leave, there are tears coming to their eyes in remembrance of their children. And it's gradually increasing without limit every time they see them. Apurva. Never before, every time. And it is never before. Because just as we can reveal ourselves more and more to a limit, Krishna can reveal himself more and more without limit. Because the definition and nature of Krishna is that he is without limit. So whatever beauty he has that attracted one, as the one's relationship develops with Krishna, that beauty increases and one's attraction. So we can't almost imagine what is spiritual reality. It's just attraction, attraction, attraction to Krishna. And happiness in that attraction, because attraction is happiness. So it's nice reading the Leela and meditating on the Leela and with other nice devotees that are coming to hear it. And, it's not unrelated to Brihad Bhagavatamrita, because what Brihad Bhagavatamrita is explaining is that ultimate reality. At the moment of its ultimate manifestation, which is Krishna. Just like ourselves, we give ourselves to people, and there may be more that we can give. And that more may manifest in different relationships. But if you can imagine yourself giving all of yourself that is good, that you have, that would be the full manifestation of yourself. So Krishna means all that God has to give is manifest, because he wants to give it, because of the force and power and intimacy of the devotee's love. But it has no limit. And it keeps on coming in that relationship. And every time you see more, and every time you see more, and it's more and more beautiful, and more alluring, and more intelligent, and more beautiful. That's Krishna. So the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, at least the part we're in, Uttara has heard about the topmost devotees of Vrindavan. And now she wants to understand the place that supports and nourishes that love. Because destination is not just the person, but destination is also the place where that person chooses to reside, which is very much connected with that person. You choose to reside in a place that facilitates your desires. Well, Krishna's desire is to exchange rasa or love. So Vrindavan is that place manifest in response to that inner desire of the ultimate reality to manifest himself fully in love. So what is that place? And because the ultimate reality is conscious, it's internal potency, it's consciousness, and it's volition and its will. That place itself is manifest out of love for Krishna. So the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, the first part of the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, is about the topmost devotees. And now Uttara, who's hearing this from Maharaj Prickett, wants to know what is that place. And she begins to put everything in context, elucidating the point that different desires fulfilled have different destinations. You have a desire for heavenly enjoyment, then there's swarga. You have a desire for ultimate liberation, which is a kind of annihilation, that is Brahman. And but if you have a desire for ultimate, spontaneous, and forceful love, then that's Vrindavan. So she really wants to understand this. So she's putting in context and she's describing that there is, at least if you start within the universe, if you start within the universe, then the level of your elevation is commensurate with the level of detachment one has. The more you're free from material desire, the less and less you're anchored in lower regions of existence. And we see that here also. The more purified your desire is, the less you're anchored in lower regions of existence. Just think of how our desires anchor us into the mode of passion and ignorance. So it describes the different paths, and it also mentioned the Bhagavatam, because Brihat Bhagavatamrita is a summary of the Bhagavatam, that there's different paths for devotees, for everyone to ascend, to any spiritualist to ascend. And as there's a gradation of enjoyment from gross to subtle, as one ascends, there's a very indirect path, and the purpose of the indirect path is it's for those who are pious. There's a facility to fulfill their desires in a way in which they can renounce them. And it's very, and then as they do that, they proceed to more and more subtle levels of enjoyment. And actually higher and higher levels of enjoyment. And in this way, they're gradually able to give up. And the last thing they give up is the false conception itself upon which the whole material world is based. And that false conception is, I am the center I am the enjoyer. I am the controller. It's not only I identify with that, but the root of identifying with it is that I want it. And somehow or other, that particular desire causes a link of identification with a particular corporal field that allows one to experience a certain level of enjoyment within an experience within that particular field. Even the evolution of the species is almost a progression of different sensual and egotistical experiences. Because that's what a body is. False ego, it's somehow an element, it's a subtle element, and it creates an identification that limits one to a particular corporal sphere. Therefore, the soul, all souls are equal, but one soul's consciousness is limited to an ant, one soul's consciousness is limited to an elephant, one soul's consciousness is limited to a male, one is limited to a female, one is limited to Indian, one is limited to American, and within those is a myriad of experiences. So eventually, by that indirect path, one gives up the false ego, the false conception of life. The beauty of bhakti is it starts with giving up the false conception of life. It starts with the most subtle thing. Bhakti is about transformation of the false ego by identification with the real ego. And that's one of the subjects of the Bhagavatam. Giving up this and accepting that. The ninth subject of the Bhagavatam is liberation. Muktir hitva yata rupam sarupena vivastita. You give up the false identification, you accept it right from the beginning. So it really strikes at the soul of materialism. Because it's all stemming from that. Everything moves from subtle to gross. Isn't it? God said, let there be light. So the begins from a subtle thing, and it manifests into a gross thing. So the most subtle thing is that identification with matter. And the subtle link that funnels the consciousness into a sphere of egotistical experience. So it described all these different destinations were based on looking for one comment here. Enjoying each of several intermediate stages and bodies more and more subtle until he attains liberation. So there's a gradual path that is being described, and the motor of that path is detachment. the motor of that path is detachment. It means how you get from one place to another is the relinquishing of the next gross desire that one has to give up. And then he goes to another desire that's more subtle. He gives that up, he goes to another one. So that was described in the different destinations. But now it describes the devotees. And it begins describing the devotees who are sakama. They have material desires. But it says also, very, but they're very elevated. It doesn't mean that this is talking about karma mishra bhakti. It's talking about devotees, and they have material desires. And it says that they're better than others. And why are they better? Because selflessness of purity of heart is the means. So bhakti is starting on that platform. But even those devotees, to become elevated and achieve perfection, even though bhakti is so powerful, they must first become purified of their material desires. I'm just going to read the purport. That's my inspiration right now. Still, although sakama bhaktis need further purification to qualify for entry into the kingdom of God, they should never be considered subject to the laws of material nature like the karmis and the ganis. As stated here, sakama bhaktis live happily in the world, free from material restraints. So it glorifies the devotees, even those who have desires. But still, they're trying to please Krishna. They're trying to surrender and serve to Krishna. Even there's one verse in the Bhagavatam that said, When you could approach Krishna even to fulfill your desires, he said that to that foolish person, one may approach God to fulfill his material desires, but for that foolish person, that's all he'll get. Meaning that there's something much higher than that. So, the path of bhakti does not have to begin with detachment. And the path of bhakti gives its fruits of purification even before one is free from material desires. And that's the point that's being made here. While other paths, the path of Gyan, there can be no real realization until one is first detached. It's described in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, you want to practice that type of path and path of self-realization. It starts with sannyas. So if you haven't given up those desires, you really can't be a Gyani yet. Because to practice it, it requires such a detachment from the world. The bhakti is nashta prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Nasta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam by Bhakti. What is Bhakti? It's serving the Bhagavat. Nitya means every day. Serving the book Bhagavat or serving the person Bhagavat. The book Bhagavat is about the person Bhagavat. The person Bhagavat speaks about the book Bhagavat. So, Nasta Prayeshu, it's all. Nityam, by that, Nasta Prayeshu, Abhadreshu, all that's abhadra and auspicious, is almost destroyed to know. So bhakti works at whatever platform one is at. And if one is sincere and trying to serve Krishna, then despite the material desires he has, the process of bhakti will purify one. I'm going to stop here. Are there any questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Okay, Nandanilal.
Maharaj, in a very nice topic, you know, you started, and although it's a short lecture today, you mentioned that, you know, if a devotee on the path, he has desire, still he is, you know, given the chance. In Bhagavatam, you know, I remember, you know, once, you know, you discussed that akama sarva kama va muksha kama udare di tibrena bhakti jogena jajatim parusham karam. Now, does Krishna take away the desire or the propensity for asking for that?
It's really nice you brought up that verse. Because, really, I have to say, going over these verses here in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, my classes, and all good classes, I feel, I don't know if my classes are good or not, but all good classes must begin with an understanding of the subject matter. Because when you understand the subject matter, then what happens is the class has a dynamicism, because everything is rooted in one point. And anybody who knows anything about writing or speaking, a good class and a good book has one point. It's called a theme. And what a theme does, it connects those points which are apparently unrelated. So even in a class, if a person says simple things, if they're related to a core point, those simple things have a dynamicism of supporting and elucidating the point that's being presented. Now, I'm presenting this, and the reason I stopped the class early, and I can be very frank, is, you know, I actually studied this section, but when I started to speak on it, it's almost like I really haven't cracked the code here. You know, and that, you know, it would take a lot more time than I have. I haven't cracked the code here. You know, and therefore, I felt the class didn't have the level of cohesion that I usually, in one sense, I pride myself in. But it's interesting, ending it early and getting questions is a way to actually solidify that. Because the verse that you brought up Tivrena Bhakti Yogena. It connects Tivrena Yoga, Tivrena Yoga, right. Akama Sarva Kama Va Moksha Kama Udaladi Tivrena Yoga, Tivrena Bhakti Yogena. Nanda Dula, I'll just say the verse again.
Pakama sarvakama va moksha kama udaradi tibrena bhakti yogena jajatri purusham param.
So tibrena bhakti yogena. Tibrena means like a ray of the sun is very, very forceful. So here it's what I'm saying is it's elucidating the verse a bit, because what it's saying is that tibrena is bhakti that is forceful. But what it's saying is akama sarva kama va moksha kama udaradi. It says who's practicing that? Akama, a devotee. Moksha kama, a jnani, one who desires liberation. Akama sarva kama va moksha kama, you have all desires. You know, a karmi. You have a desire for moksha, jnani, a kama, a pure devotee. But tibrena, they're all somehow practicing bhakti. They're somehow all forcefully practicing the path of bhakti. And what it says is if you do that, you achieve your goal, you achieve perfection. So basically with that's referring to us. We may have so many desires, we may have so many things we want, we may be whatever it is. But if we're forceful in our practice of Krishna consciousness, yajeta purusham param, then there'll be perfection. So I think what it's elucidating is actually, it's interesting, it's elucidating really what it said here. Because what it wants to do is compare it's talking about how people, and it was first talking about the karmis and the jnanis, how they can ascend through the universe like that. And now it's saying the same thing, that even a devotee who is with desires and bunjata, Shuka, Boga, Shuka, and is enjoying pleasures. And what it says, they can have those things. And those things may even come. But the bhakti will move them forward. And therefore, it says, Sanatana Goswami uses the word bhunjana, enjoying, in the form of present tense to indicate that even while Vaishnavas are finishing up their last enjoyment of the material world, the power of the Lord's devotional service purifies them enough to demolish all the obstacles in their heart. And I have that sense that a real Vaishnava, he's dedicated to serving Krishna. But he may have some karma. He may have some desires to fulfill. It's not like the jnani. You can't be the jnani. You can't be the meditator if you're harboring these things. But here it says the bhakta, even if he has, of course they should be fulfilled within a religious way. But even Prabhupada said, even a drunk, if he takes wine and he thinks that, you know, the taste is Krishna, he'll make advancement. You know, the key, and there's some verse, I forgot where it's quoted. I quoted it someplace in a journal that I wrote, how even one with material desires, the key is to be humble and just recognize I'm not at the goal, but not lose enthusiasm to serve Krishna, to perform devotionals. Right? And you can see that in image of someone who may even have some habits or something, but they're pure in the sense that their real intention is they want to please Krishna. They want to please Krishna. They want to do service. And it's so attractive because bhakti is about attracting Krishna. And Krishna is attracted to one who's humble and dependent. And there may be someone who's completely free from material desires in one sense, but they're proud of that. And therefore, there's all kinds of verses within the Bhagavatam that state that, and it's one of my favorite statements, at least in a philosophical concept, that one may have all 12 brahminical qualities, but that person, if he's not a devotee, and devotee means you've stepped out of the center, and that you want to be an object for the pleasure of God and his devotees, and you're happy with that, that if one is not a devotee, and therefore keeps the egotistical conception, then he won't be able to liberate himself, even if you have all 12 brahminical qualities, because they will be appropriated by the false ego. To bolster the false ego, I am the controller, I am the enjoyer, and I'm a Brahmin, and I'm clean, and I'm tolerant, I'm self-controlled, and I'm learned, and I'm... And it says, even if one's born in the family of dog eaters, if he's a devotee, he can save the world. Why? Because he's humble. It doesn't mean he's in a high material position, even in Vanashram, or even in the modes. But if the person's humble, then he can attract Krishna's mercy. So here, it's a devotee, they may have desires, and that may be their karma. And of course, to be elevated, they'll have to become purified of the desires. But how do they become purified of the desires? They become purified of desires by dedicating themselves to Krishna. And when you dedicate yourself to Krishna, when you dedicate yourself to God, which begins from the platform of humility, you begin to feel your relationship with God in the form of mercy, which invokes and develops love within one's heart. And as that love develops within one's heart, the very lacking that is at the root of so many desires and addictions becomes filled. So this is how the process of bhakti works. Primarily, it's humility. And humility fosters a dependence on God that allows one to experience mercy. And that experience of mercy is everything in spiritual life. It's everything in spiritual life. Because our attraction for God will be inspired by the mercy we feel in that relationship. So therefore, even if the devotee is not, as it's mentioned here, on a very elevated platform, or if it's not, whatever, even if the devotee is not on a very elevated platform, it says burdened by material desires, they're in a better position because they ultimately have the best position to give up those material desires, which is the platform of humility and dependence. So in that sense, even though the devotee may be the dog eater and the other person may be the Brahmin, the dog eater is in a better position because he's humble. And that humility will allow that person to experience and feel a level of God's love in the form of mercy that will eventually detach that person from subtle and gross desires above the one on a ganic path, which is dependent on one's own powers. And because it's dependent on one's own powers, it tends to foster egoism and pride, which in the Narada Bhakti Sutta says God dislikes. It's an ascending process. It's your power. But bhakti is not an ascending process. It goes on a different line. It goes on the path of dependence. And mercy. And if our sadhana is anything, our sadhana is a process to purify the heart, to allow us to express a dependence on God. That's bhakti. It's not just the amount of rounds one does, although it may very well be connected, because the taste for that, in most cases, or many cases, or some cases, but the taste for that should be the taste one has for entreaty and prayer that comes from feeling dependent on God. Okay, thank you, Nandadula.
Thank you, Maharaj, for your excellent explanation of this. Because I had also little doubt when you mentioned the bhakta's desire fulfills, because we are indoctrinated by anabhilashana shunyam. So these things was disturbing me when you were speaking that
anabhilashita shunyam, that's what uttama bhakti is. So here it says a devotee whose devotion is mixed, who desires to must first be purified. But that's uttama bhakti. That's uttama bhakti. And still, even if one with desires, you may have a desire for something or this or that, but when you're practicing devotional service, hopefully the desire is not let me get that desire fulfilled, but Krishna, patam pushpam palamta. You may be a dog eater, you may be filled with desires, but when you go before and worship the deity, it doesn't mean that you have to have, that it can't be pure devotional service. You may be offering this flower, Krishna, please accept this. I'm a humble, useless beggar. Please give me love of Godhead. I want to please you. So you can practice pure devotional service even if there's material desires in your heart. It's just that you're not performing your devotional service for the purpose of fulfilling those material desires. You're performing devotional service for the purpose of pleasing Krishna and purifying your heart and coming to the platform of pure devotional service. So, yeah, it's not pure devotional service if your intention is not to please Krishna. And if there's any drop of desire for yourself in that activity, it is not pure devotional service. But it doesn't mean that someone with material desires can't perform pure devotional service. He just can't perform devotional service, pure devotional service, for the fulfillment of those desires. But devotional service is really becoming dependent and becoming humble, wherever we are at. Whether or not we're an elevated jnani with no material desires, that doesn't make one the best bhakta. Or, we're in the modes and we have so many desires. But you can think, there are people who have bad habits and things, but they're very sincere. They don't want those habits, they want to serve Krishna. And whatever little service they do for the pleasure of Krishna, with an entreaty, crying out to Krishna. And then there may be someone who's more disciplined and a better sadhaka. But their objectives are something else. But we can also understand, and this is true, when you do get real devotion, and very quickly you become purified, and therefore it's unlikely that someone with very, very high devotional sentiments has also gross material activities, because once the devotion comes in the heart, then very, very quickly one becomes detached, which is another reason why a devotee burdened by material desires is in a better position. He's come to a higher position. Because spiritual advancement means the purity of the heart. And what is the purity of the heart if it's not selflessness and devotion? What else can purity of the heart be? What else can elevation in consciousness be? So, a devotee, he may be burdened, but he's in a better position. Because he's more selfless. And if he's not, like Prabhupada said, a Vaishnava is better than a Goswami. He says that in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that if he ceased to be following and not practicing devotion, then you can't say that. Okay, anybody else like to say hello? We have some questions.
Maharaj?
Yeah.
Maharaj, you there? Oh. Would a question be okay, Maharaj? It's Mahamuni. Would you rather...
Yeah. It would be very helpful today.
Okay, well, first of all, on behalf of those people who think they're devotees but have a lot of desires, I want to thank you for addressing our needs in this class. But I guess, Maharaj, it seemed to me one thing that, to my mind, was kind of coming up quite a bit in the class today was, it strikes me that there's a really interesting kind of razor's edge, so to speak, a kind of really delicate divide between, like, on one hand, there's what we've seen in the... Remember, there's those really beautiful verses in the Bhagavatam 11th canto where it says, a devotee who has desires... You know, they may very deeply internally be frustrated with themselves, but Krishna says they should be happy and be peaceful and just continue their practice. You know, that it'll don't crucify yourself. Just keep performing bhakti. I forget the Sanskrit, but it's like 11:24 or something. And there's also the Bhagavad Gita. Sorry, Marsh?
No, it was a beautiful verse. I once quoted it. Yeah.
Yeah, and also like in like chapter 9, verse 30, right? Apiche Suduracharo, someone who is currently, Sri Jiva says, I think, currently performing sinful activities, they still should be considered a sadhu, even if they're rightly situated in their determination. And so what I wanted to ask you was, on one hand, it seems like there's this very powerful and deep point about bhakti, that wherever you're at, If you are in a sincere way trying to come to Krishna, that's the central thing, and this other stuff is inconsequential and shouldn't be used kind of as a way to discriminate. But on the other hand, we also see, and something that I've seen you say in the past, that if you try to distinguish between people according to like their ideology or what they say they believe, that's often really superficial. And so there's times where I've seen people say, well, he's a devotee, meaning, i.e., he identifies with like Prabhupada's movement or something. And, yeah. And, you know, he's a devotee, so he's okay, you know. And so I think you started talking about this when you mentioned the point about are you taking yourself out of the center or not? Is that like, what's the deep point here that really what it means to be a devotee is what I'm asking? And not, you know, not just some kind of institutional allegiance or something.
Yeah, well.
Well, I didn't, the latter thing, that was a throwaway line, Marge. I didn't mean it in some biting
way. I was going to quickly make some point, but anyway. But here's the point. I really think, you know, what happened today, again, I want to say is that, you know, I just, you know, I couldn't, whole context, somehow or other, I think to understand these verses, I'd have to study deeply, like 20 verses ahead, to put this whole thing in context of what's happening. And generally speaking, I generally don't speak unless I understand the text and I'm pretty confident of how it fits in. But in terms of this point that's being brought up by it, which is maybe the every cloud has a silver lining thing, is I really think it's really going to come down to sincerity, you know? And in one's actions and conscious, willful behavior, is one really wanting to please Krishna? You know, there's one thing with, you know, like, for example, you know, you can have someone who's very, very renounced, right? So he doesn't have a lot of impulses, right? But his conscious, within his volition control, right, and he knows it, right? He wants to be recognized. He wants to be great, you know? He wants, mm-hmm. you know, it's a centered, non-devotional thing. So I think it really comes down to, you know, where almost one's conscious volition, where they put it. Because we know they're overwhelming impulses. And, of course, you have to be careful not to use it as an excuse, like take verses like this, because then you will be cheating.
Yeah.
You know, you will be corrupting your attitude. You know, I can self-introspect myself. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's really, you know, it's not enough to be sadhana. You know, it's not enough, you know, to listen to Vrindavan, you know. It's your insincerity and honesty. And I remember, when Advaita got initiated by Haridas Shastri, and I always tell this story, you know. Advaita is a scholar, you know, he's a professor, you know, he's a Sanskritist. So he's waiting for the initiation lecture. You know, he's waiting for the initiation lecture, and he really wants to hear something deep on Guru Tattva. And Haridas Shastri just says, gave two words, be honest. We hear someone who's, you know, got 9 PhDs in Vaishnava philosophy, however it works, whatever they're called, but be honest. So I guess it's that sincerity that you actually, in the core of your heart, right, you want to please Krishna, you know, and that's what bhakti is. And beyond that, there may be all kinds, you know, you're not purified yet, and it'll have to be purified. But if you have that, and therefore take a veil of the opportunities that you do have karmically and volition and by volition, you'll become purified. You know, and contrast that to someone who has, something more elevated, an external practice. But I guess it comes down to motive, okay? I guess it comes down to motive, right? Bhakti comes down to motive. It depends what a person's motive is, their core motive in life. And I guess a bhakti is core motive in life. I should please Krishna. Am I able to do it? Am I filled with faults? You know, and I always remember also the story of, it can't be taken too far, but it does say something. And it's our friend Denny, right? The comedian, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, she was struggling so much with everything, you know? Karmically, it's very difficult for her to take the devotional service, right? But I remember one day Radhanath Swami came to the temple in Second Avenue, right? And, you know, she came to see him. So at the end of the class, everyone was at his feet, you know, and he just sat there and talked to everyone. And then he started to walk out the side, and she was just, as you come out, you know how that it kind of turns and gets a little wider at one place in Second Avenue or something towards the back and something.
Yeah.
You know, she was just like in that corner, just like there, and he just went and then he turned to her. And then she broke down in tears, right? And she just said, I remember it was very moving, she said, I'm so fallen, you know? I do nothing. But I just feel so much solace that there's people like you going around the world sharing, you know, Krishna consciousness to others. And then she goes down in tears. And I can't tell you, I don't want to say what else Radhanath Swami said, but how much he appreciated that, you know. So again, I mean, it may not be the highest devotion, but it's something. It definitely was beyond her level of practice. Her devotion, you know what I'm saying, and her sincerity in that regard, you know. So I think it's something like that, and there may have been someone there that may have been in the movement for 30 years, and you know, maybe chanting this and completely envious, and really, you know, maybe wanting to be a, at the top or control people, or you know, the objective was just that, you know, let me be. You know, a big devotee, let me be in control, let me, you know, whatever it is. And again, I don't want to underestimate the purity it does take to commit yourself to sadhana too, really, to have a taste, to actually chant and things like that too. But it's just not an absolute correlation. Whoops, battery is low. I'm going to have to quickly plug it in. That's okay. I think I got a few minutes. So, Moody, go on, because...
No, I really appreciate that, and it's really moving to remember our old friend Denny in that way.
Wait, one second.
Sure.
The nature of this phone is it can't have a plug and a gear plug at the same time. What do you think?
I'm saying I really appreciated your point, and it was touching to remember Denny in that way. I guess, Marge, what you're bringing up when you said about it's about your motives. I haven't done a lot of research in what's called action theory, but there's a lot of interesting discussion by thinkers about the difference between. Or like the difference between the desire that may pop up and a much more intimate desire, which is really flowing from your core sense of what you are. And where, you know, like, so for example, you know, like a drug addict may have what are called first order desires to get drugs, but they might have second order desires, which is how they think about their own desires. And their second order desire is, I don't want to desire drugs. and so, I guess what the way I'm understanding what you're saying is that, you know, because by our conditioning we may have so many impulses, and the fact is a lot of people can't just give them up. But there's another kind of impulse which is not just a kind of conditioned response, but it flows from our deep sense of what we value and what we are. And somehow, if that can be attuned toward Krishna, that's like the central. That's the most important thing to do. Anyway, that's how I understood you, Maharaj. Was that okay?
And I think that's what bhakti is when it talks about a devotee with material desires. It's talking about that and not someone, you know, who has material desires and, you know, kind of just has a dress of a devotee. You know what I'm saying? And their core inner being is, I want to be the controller and enjoyer. I want to get ahead. I wish I was, you know, controlling this movement. I would have more facility, you know. So there is something like that. And, I think in discussions like this, it's nice because it brings out so many points that can actually be thought about, discussed about, and written about, you know, in devotion, you know. And I like that in this regard, you know, cross-references to other philosophers are helpful, you know, who've thought about kind of similar issues as this in other spheres, you know. It's good.
Marsh, there's like two or three other things that could come up, but it seems like we've gone on a while, so I could shelve them for...
Sorry, Marsh?
One thing related to this that I wanted to ask you, I mean, so do you think at the times we have our sadhana, and, you know, you've been kind to give me a lot of good direction over the years about how to make sadhana that works, you know, in the midst of everything else in life. Do you think that the goal of sadhana should be to try to have a time of the day where we can really just develop that mood of dependence? Like, in other words, you know, because we may do RT, we may read something, we may do puja, or sorry, we may chant or something, but do you think that it would be more effective if we really consciously think, okay, now I have my 45 minutes or whatever, let me try to cultivate a sense of dependence through this action?
Well, the activities itself are supposed to cultivate, you know, but if you can keep the objective in mind, I think it would be more effective. And I think that's also a principle also, because sadhana means to do things with an objective. You know, that's the definition of what Goswami gives in sadhana, you know. Your objective is if you want love of Krishna, and therefore you're engaging your senses for that purpose. So I think there's another philosophical point here in terms of spiritual practice, is that practice is done with an objective. And if you can bring the objective to the forefront, obviously the practice is going to be much more powerful. You know? So I definitely think one has to be mindful of what one's objective is when they're sitting, you know, I have to finish my rounds, you know. It's not bhakti, it's pure sense. Because pure bhakti, in the purest definition, I don't think that's what we practice. I think that's more like, you know, Brahmanism, you know. But I think the pure Vaidhi bhakti is, I have faith in rules. If I complete things, then the rule... the completion of the rule, the power of the rule. But bhakti is supposed to be love, and love is not a fruitive, love is not in the future, love is now. So I think bhakti is that kind of spirit of humility and dependence. And I think the more one carries that into one's practices, the more relevant they become moment by moment. You know? It's like, you know, again, a chanting your rounds and feeling that the power comes when the last beat is put down. Even if you skipped every syllable, you know, even if you were, you know, looking at your computer at the same time, you know, that somehow the benefit came because I finished. Rather than the consciousness that comes... independence, yeah. So I think definitely that's effective. Okay, what time is it now, Mooney? There.
It's quarter after seven. It's quarter after ten, Marsh.
Oh, okay.
Quarter after ten.
Okay, it's not okay. All right, you can ask one more question.
Well, again, though, Marge, I don't want to. I worry of being that guy, you know.
Anyway, you're not being that guy because I'm asking you.
All right. Well, the only other thing, Marge, that struck me about what you're not the only, but one other thing that struck me was, you know, recently. I guess I'll start it by saying I think I sometimes have a very superficial idea of what it means to believe in God. And
yeah.
I think your class today is reminding me that to believe in God means something more than thinking there's some proposition you accept is true. Like a friend recently kind of confided in me that he felt like he lost his faith. And when I was thinking about what he said, I realized that I don't want to fall into this danger that, like, the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche complained about modern European life. He said, none of you believe in God anymore, and you don't even realize it, you know? And I think that there's a way in which, you know, I can believe there's a proposition about God, that God exists, and I can have some idea that's true. But unless one really tries to internalize this notion of God being in the center, you can kind of live a life where God really doesn't exist for you. And I don't know, you're just kind of,
fact.
It's just, I've...
This fact really is a fact, no. I mean, right, God doesn't exist in your practical vision, your practical life. God should be a reality. We should, you know, yeah, at least, if we don't see God, you should at least see ourselves as God's servants, you know? Okay. Yeah, Mooney, I guess...
Thank you, Marsh.
Okay, it's good. Anybody else like to say hello that's still on quickly?
Hare Krishna.
Hi, Bogiel.
I wish it weren't 20 after 10.
What?
I said, I wish it were not 20 after 10.
Why?
Because now I can't ask you what I need to ask you.
Okay, I have to give you equal. This is an unusual class, but go ahead.
You know, I just feel that I experience so much responsiveness from Krishna. And in addition to that, I feel like everything about my life, you know, is dependent on him.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering what has to happen before having these experiences, you know, realizing that my existence is dependent on him and everything that happens in my life is dependent on him, and having the countless, you know, experiences of affection that he has given me.
Yeah.
I'm wondering when those things will have the fruit of my sincerely from the heart wanting to do my service for his happiness, actually, and not just out of my, you know, just because I know I should, because this is, you know, what a soul, a real soul, pure soul, liberated soul does. You know, why is that, you know, why is my service not, you know, really, really from the heart, despite my experiences, countless experiences, and the realization that my existence depends on him.
Well, it's kind of a personal question, and kind of a public forum. But, and I think it would take a longer discussion than we have.
Okay.
I did also think before the sometimes things imperceptibly grow beyond our perception. And the example is given of a fig tree, which gives fruit every 2 years. You know, it doesn't look like it's growing, but it will happen. And when it happens, if I can feel it happen, it happened when the appropriate experience was there, then the full surrender that allowed him access was growing in his heart by chance Namabad. So I don't think it's a small thing that someone feels responded and responded, not despondent, and dependent, and sees Krishna's mercy, and some sentiments and feelings are there. And took a verse of his favorite desires. And
I'm not able to, the line is not good anymore. Somehow.
Much to your line, Dale.
Well, it just happened now.
If you send me an email, I'll see you personally with your phone number. Okay, because it only costs me 35 rupees an hour now. Okay? Really, send me an email, and I'll pull it. Okay?
All right, thank you.
I think it's your line. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Chris in Pennsylvania.
Chris, great. You came here last year about this time. Wonderful.
Yes.
Hey, anybody else like to say hello? Chris, why don't you come down to the board? Who's that?
Indrani,
Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
I'm always tempted to you in Kolkata.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Shastra, if you're on the phone, I sent you an email about the different flights. You should give me a response. I can pick it to go to Puri. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, we'll end today. Hare Krishna. Bunch of couple through this.